I'm going to address a somewhat controversial topic, but I believe it to be extraordinarily important, and that is the relationship between pneumococcal disease and influenza. So one of those common slides then is this one, which is my unapologetic slide for working on the pneumococcus. So these are the major infectious causes of death globally. And AIDS, you can see, is on the list, as is TB and malaria. And those are the three that people mostly think of when they think of global scourges of infectious diseases. But in fact, acute respiratory infections, which is basically pneumonia deaths, are still the number one cause of death in the world. And the pneumococcus and influenza play an enormous role in these deaths. And you see that there's an equal distribution of deaths in the over five, which is not six-year-olds, it's actually 65 plus, and the under fives, which are in fact the very young. So if you look at pneumonia morbidity, this is just one of many examples I could have given of the burden of disease in the very young and the very old. Now, there is a new vaccine, a conjugate pneumococcal vaccine, which is available in the United States, and most of our experience of this vaccine introduction has been in the U.S., and what it has shown is that the disease in the very young is related to the disease in the very old. And that's shown on this slide, and this just shows how the burden of invasive pneumococcal disease due to the types in the vaccine has reduced in the United States since the introduction of the vaccine. It was introduced here in the year 2000. This is the year before introduction. And then the prevalence of these strains has remarkably reduced in young kids who are vaccinated. But the disease burden has also gone down in the elderly, and the explanation for that is that the vaccine interrupts carriage. So the pneumococcus is carried, and when children are vaccinated, they are unable to transmit the organism to other immunized kids. This interrupts transmission, and so the disease burden goes down. Now, unfortunately, this doesn't project very well, but it shows that pneumonia in the United States, here, all-cause pneumonia, and these are all the age groups, again, going right up to 65 years of age, appears to be reducing in the United States. So the vaccine seems to be reducing both invasive disease and pneumonia through herd immunity. But I am introducing the vaccine because we were able to use the vaccine as a probe to investigate something else, and that is influenza. So as important as the pneumococcus is to global mortality, these are the events which could cause deaths of more than a million people in the next 50 years. So it's a slide that looks at previous mortality and then projects the likelihood of future mortality. And it starts out with some rather unlikely things, such as asteroids. Now, you may not lose a lot of sleep worrying about an asteroid falling on your head, but asteroids have hit the Earth in the past and will do so in the future, we assume. And therefore, because we have evidence of how often they hit the Earth, we can project the likely mortality from an asteroid. So in fact, the likelihood of one death from an asteroid in the next 50 years is about 20%, but that's only one death. The likelihood of a million people dying is 0.01%, so it's one in 10,000. On the other hand, volcanoes and tsunamis are projected to cause approaching 100% likelihood of causing between 100,000 and 500,000 deaths, and as we know recently, there was a tsunami responsible for 200,000 deaths. Major wars are responsible for an enormous mortality, and the projection is around 5 million deaths in the next 50 years. If you look at the last 50 years, there were probably more than that. But the number one projected cause of global mortality is influenza. And based on the last 50 years, or in fact the last few hundred years, since 1891 and beyond that, we would project between 10 and 50 million deaths from influenza in the next 50 years. So influenza is a huge cause of mortality. Now, what does this have to do with the bacterium, the pneumococcus, and this new vaccine? Well, there are a number of relationships between the virus and the bacterium. The one that I'm not going to go into in depth, but I thought I'd just share with you some interesting data that seemed to have been forgotten. This is a study from the 1950s, and it looked at pneumococcal carriage in families, adults and children. And what it shows is that when there was a cold in the family, when individuals had a cold, the ability to identify the pneumococcus, these are the percentage of positive swabs for a pneumococcus, was much, much higher than when there was no cold in members of the family. So what this suggests is that upper respiratory viral infections, and it could be influenza or in fact any of them, probably play a major role in transmission of the pneumococcus. And the only other slide I want to put in this is 1958, I thought I'll have one from 50 years later. This is from 2008, totally different community. These are now kids in Kenya, and they were looking at both pneumococcal carriage and Haemophilus influenzae carriage. And again, they asked about coryza, which is an upper respiratory tract infection, and the odds ratios for pneumococcal carriage and for Haemophilus influenzae carriage were both up in those with upper respiratory tract infections. So influenza might increase the dissemination of the pneumococcus in the community. Now, other interactions between influenza and the pneumococcus is that influenza really affects our ability to kill pneumococci. So the major cell that kills pneumococci is the neutrophil. And if you have influenza with the pneumococcus, you kill neutrophils. And many of the cytokines that are produced by influenza, such as TNF and IL-alpha, increase exposure of the pneumococcus to receptors, such as the PAF receptor, which allow pneumococcal invasion. Now, I'm not going to go into all of this in great detail. There's an enzyme called neuraminidase produced by both the pneumococcus and influenza, and we believe that that might also be important in the synergistic activity. But I want you to concentrate now on the last slide I'm going to show you on basic biology, and that is what happens if you give pneumococcus to a mouse that has influenza. Now, you may not be interested in mice, but I'm going to show you what happens to mice, and then we're going to see what happens to humans. So start up here. If you give 10 mice non-lethal influenza, then this is survival. And this is a very low dose of influenza, and it's non-lethal, so the 10 mice all survive. And then you can take another 10 mice, and you can give them non-lethal pneumococcus. So that's the virus, and now these mice got non-lethal pneumococcal exposure, and they were supposed to all live, but one unfortunately died. So it wasn't a perfect experiment, but basically these are non-lethal influenza and non-lethal pneumococcus. If you then take another group of 10 mice, and you give them the non-lethal flu, but 7 days later, you see here, 7 days later, you give them the non-lethal pneumococcus, this is what happens. Every one of the mice die. So non-lethal flu, nobody dies, or no mouse dies. Non-lethal pneumo, no mice dies. You give them flu and then pneumo, and they all die. If you do it the other way around, you give them pneumococcus followed by flu, there's no death. So there's something bad for mice if they get a pneumococcus just after they've had influenza. So what about humans? So this is where the vaccine comes in. We really don't have a good way of identifying pneumococcal disease. But we did a very large vaccine trial in Soweto, South Africa, of pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. This vaccine prevents pneumococcal disease, should have no effect on upper respiratory tract infections such as influenza. But when we looked for influenza-associated hospitalization with pneumonia, labeled here for cases are in fact the kids who got pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, and here are the controls. And the equal number of cases and controls in the study was a large study, nearly 40,000 kids, 20,000 in each group. And you would have expected that influenza-associated hospitalization should be equal, but it wasn't. There's 45% reduction in influenza-associated hospitalization in children who got the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. So what do we think is happening here? We think it's exactly like the mice. We think that if humans get influenza, they get sick, but they don't necessarily get hospitalized. If they get a pneumococcus with the influenza, they get hospitalized with both. And if they get the vaccine, which prevents the pneumococcus, then that happens less often, so they don't get as much influenza-associated morbidity. And other viruses, we found the same thing. All these numbers are lower in the vaccinated kids. So it seems that getting the pneumococcal vaccine stops you getting infection with virus plus pneumococcus, and that the infections with the combination are severe enough to land you in hospital. So now let's look back at the great influenza of 1918, and asked the question, was there a burden of pneumococcal disease at that time? We know there was enormous mortality, but what about the pneumococcal disease? So this is the question. Did bacterial infection, especially the pneumococcus, play a role in mortality during 1918? Well, it turns out that there was this kind of shape mortality. In fact, there's a poster by Loni Simonson at the other meeting showing that in other parts of the world, all of the mortality was in the 20 to 30-year-olds. But whatever the shape of the curve, this was the overall mortality. Then above that, you get pneumonia complications, and they were about 10 times more common. So this is a log scale. And then there's the mortality from the pneumonia. So most of this overall mortality, if you just work out these percentages, was explained by the case fatality of the complicating pneumonias. And so here's a picture in a military camp in the United States of the influenza sweeping through. This is just days of the epidemic. There's the influenza. And then in the same camp, Camp Pike, here is the pneumonia that followed the influenza. So it was a little bit later. In another camp, here's influenza plus pneumonia. So some of this, probably this was the influenza, and there's the shoulder of the pneumonia. And then the deaths really were timed with the following pneumonia. So another way of looking at this is here is the mortality during 1918. And many people have argued that that virus, that influenza, was so overwhelming that people died during the influenza, in other words, during the first 4 days. But in fact, the mortality was not mostly during the first 4 days. So this early mortality would probably be influenza alone, perhaps some of this mortality up to 7 days, but the mortality in the second and third week probably was due to the bacterial superinfection, the same thing that the vaccine prevented, these pneumococcal superinfections. So what evidence do we actually have that the pneumococcus was killing people during 1918? Well, the first is relatively indirect. We have the time to death there of influenza. Let's look at the time to death, which is this curve, of untreated pneumococcal bacteremia. So these are patients from the 1930s who were untreated. Why? Because there were no antibiotics in the 1930s. And if you plot here the pandemic deaths, this is time to death, and you plot the pneumococcal deaths, time to death, you see they're almost superimposable. Now, that doesn't mean that it's proof, but certainly it suggests that the time to death of bacterial of the pneumococcus in the blood was identical to the time to death during that epidemic. So now the second best evidence that the pneumococcus may have played a role is, well, when those people died, did anybody do postmortems? And if they did they look for the pneumococcus? Well, it turns out that they did. And there are a whole lot of studies, some quite large. There's 280 fatal pneumonias, and 28% of them, they were able to culture a pneumococcus from heart blood. And this is 80, and 65% they grew a pneumococcus, and this is a much smaller one of 9 they grew from heart blood in 3. So that's pretty convincing evidence, but it is after death, and many things happen after death, and you can't be 100% sure that this was pneumococcal bacteremia. So what about living patients? The best evidence of pneumococcal bacteremia is to find it in living patients before they die. These are all patients with influenza during the pandemic, and here's 15 patients, and 5 of them, that's a third, had a pneumococcus in the blood. Here's 90 patients, and 45 of them, half of them, had a pneumococcus in the blood. And finally, here's 111 patients, and 50 of them, 45%, had a pneumococcus in the blood. So overall, 216 blood cultures taken during the epidemic of patients with pneumonia, and 100 of them had a pneumococcus. So the evidence, I think, is overwhelming that the pneumonias associated with death in the patients during 1918 were associated with pneumococcal superinfection. Now the question is, are there plans then to prevent pneumococcal superinfections in the pandemic planning of the US and other countries? And in fact, there's very little attention at the moment. There's beginning to be attention. The US is beginning to look at strengthening indications for pneumococcal disease. And certainly at the moment, although many, perhaps 80% of kids get conjugate vaccine, 4 doses, and the 4th dose may be important for this herd immunity, only 50% of kids are getting 4 doses. And the adult vaccine, the 23-valent vaccine, although widely given, probably does prevent bacteremia in young people. So if indeed the influenza in a pandemic associated with bacteremia in young people, then in fact it may also play a role. So in summary then, Pneumococcal morbidity is associated with viral respiratory infections. The vaccine has reduced hospitalization associated with those. The majority, I believe, of mortality in 1918 was attributable to bacterial infections, especially the pneumococcus. And finally, then, pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, both with the conjugate vaccine and with the adult vaccine, should be considered as a part of pandemic flu planning. Thanks for your attention.